and culture. So go sunny, Denet A. You take good care of yourselves out there. I'm Christine Genier. This is Words and Culture.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin.
Soko seni denit e. Minen yujihina.
Ekose.
Kakuudau. We'll see you again.
This is Bird Note. At midday, it might seem like the birds that were so active in the morning have gone silent, maybe even vanished. But there are some birds that, much like people, rally in the afternoon, offering a second chance to see and hear them. Cormorants are sleek water birds that dive for fish. There are cormorant species found all over the world. The double-crested cormorant is the most common in North America. During the summer breeding season, this species has two peak times for hunting. The first around 9 a.m. and the second around 3 p.m. So if you're out in the afternoon, you might find a cormorant hard at work diving for fish. Cormorants don't spend most of their time looking for food, though. They catch their prey efficiently, letting them spend most of their day loafing around, drying their feathers in the sun, and croaking at their neighbors. Sounds like an ideal day for many human anglers, too. Reel in a few fish, then kick back and relax. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Support for Bird Note is provided by Ellen Blackstone from Edmonds, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
Oh my! Oh me! Oh, you will wait and see what we have coming for you! The Allied Nation is not a joke, my friends, and you will all find out soon enough! Hallucimania will be the end of one nation and the beginning of the rise of the allied kind. Hallucination, you had your time. Now it's mine.
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
Is getting out of the way of Mother Nature on Sumas Prairie cheaper and perhaps even justified? The authors of a University of British Columbia research paper probed this question now nearly 3 years after the November 2021 flood and 100 years after the waters of Sumas Lake were drained to make way for the farms that dot the lake bed today. The paper's lead writer is Riley Finn. He's a staff researcher in UBC's Conservation Decisions Lab. Finn says the paper has three angles.
One of them was to really kind of situate the history of how Sumas Lake became Sumas Prairie. Then we wanted to get an understanding of, you know, what are the potential costs of returning the lake? And, you know, what does a potentially more inclusive process for determining the future look like. And so to get at those second two pieces, we looked at the assessed land values that come from BC assessments, and we overlaid historical mapping of the lake boundary on top of those.
Finn says to then determine a future with a restored Sumas Lake, the paper draws on the RELAW program,
which is revitalizing laws for land and water, which is a program run out of West Coast Environmental Law. And they worked a lot with First Nations in the Lower Fraser to kind of codify legal codes from oral histories and community dialogue.
My name is Murray Ned. Ancestral name is Klawsinton from Tsamath. And I guess a couple of capacities, Mike. I a former counselor for Sumas First Nation, but I remain as an advisor to the nation, specific to this file. And then also I work for the Lower Fraser Fisheries Alliance as their executive director.
And Ned's family tree is directly connected to the opposition to draining the lake in the first place.
My late great grandfather was the chief back then. His name was Selsmilton. That was his ancestral name. And he was the one that opposed the lake back, well, the draining of the lake back in the 1920s, but they proceeded anyway. So
Ned worked closely with Finn on this paper.
We don't want to do the same kind of displacement that the nation and our ancestors that lived there before when the lake was drained. We know what it's like to be displaced. We know what it's like to lose that piece of the ecosystem. And today it's invaluable.
The paper explores a path where the Sumas Prairie becomes something of a hybrid of what the area looks like today, mixed with what it might have looked like a century ago.
There are stories from back when the lake still existed of, you know, cattle being grazed and crops being raised around the lake. So this was something that was occurring before the lake was gone. And I don't think it's unreasonable to imagine a future where, you know, you could have some of both with a more resilient to potential flooding events.
The lake was renowned for having all five salmon species plus steelhead and, you know, wildlife, elk running around here.
And how does a revitalized lake bed make inroads toward reconciliation?
We would be interested in return of the lake if it didn't have such an impact on the local people. And so perhaps what we're after is maybe something in between that doesn't affect the people and the agricultural industry as much. And if there's, you know, willingness for people to think about a bit of a transformation from what we're doing today.
The study estimates a managed retreat buying up lake bed properties would cost about $1 billion, less than half of the $2.4 billion cited by the paper to bolster flood mitigation infrastructure.
So when we looked at kind of the overlay of the lake bed with the surrounding properties, we found that the assessments data attached to kind of the parcels in the region were about $1 billion in terms of the assessed values. And so, yeah, those might be different than what the market values are, but, you know, the data we have is the BC assessments data. So that's what we found looking at kind of a broad area in terms of the lake bed as well as the surrounding floodplain around it.
Politically, Abbotsford Mayor Ross Seaman says the concept is a non-starter.
Not on my watch.
Siemens thinks the report has, quote, so many inconsistencies, end quote.
Just based on reality, but I would invite people to come and take a look at what is happening on Sumas Prairie and get your head in the game. That is a no-go in my estimation.
Siemens says protecting the farmland on the Sumas Prairie is critical.
Well, this is the most valuable farmland in the country, the most productive. The fact is, where do we find arable land like that anywhere else in the province? So our food security, number one, this is people's livelihoods. These are third, fourth generation farmers that are now responsible for, you know, 50 to 60% of our dairy and poultry in the entire province of British Columbia are coming out of Abbotsford, and a vast majority of that's coming out of that prairie. People have invested their livelihoods are here, their homes. That is just absolutely ridiculous.
When it comes to food security, Ned draws a through line from today to the past.
It's an irony. To me, as a nation member, it's an irony. They determined it was feasible to drain the lake back then and get rid of the food security that they had in the form of the lake. And then today, you know, they're talking about hanging on to industry and all the economic and livelihood considerations that occur with that. So, you know, I guess what we're looking at is trying to figure out a balance between what we have today and what we had in the past.
Let's not forget that British Columbia has to import food too. It's a two-way street. We can't just rely on others to be supplying our food. That is absolutely, you know, in today's changing world when people are trying to protect their own areas, I mean, for us to just cut loose on food security is, you know, that is just a ridiculous notion from my perspective.
Finn says the paper tries to imagine a future where a version of Sumas Lake could be an economic engine for the Fraser Valley.
Like tourism and recreation and how the value of the lake might bring people to the region in terms of, you know, the economically important species that it might support, such as salmon and sturgeon. You know, what is the value of recreational fishing and food and ceremonial fisheries for the nations, as well as commercial fisheries that the lake might help produce. So there are lots of potential knock-on positive effects that, you know, we would have to essentially spend quite a bit of time trying to model out in order to get a proper idea of, you know, what are the costs and benefits.
We want it to be productive. We want the water to be healthy. We want the associated species, salmon and other wildlife, to be able to utilize it in a good way.
For now, Mayor Siemens is unambiguous.
Just to assure that my residents that I've got their back on this one, and I will go to the wall on that.
As for Finn, he's not fazed when confronted with opposition to the premise of a revitalized lake.
Our lab looks at decision science, and so, you know, really getting a broad view of the potential alternatives and considering, you know, what are the values that we're really trying to achieve. I think we just kind of saw that the broadest set of alternatives weren't really being considered, and there might be value in, you know, bringing a broader discussion.
For Civil Radio, I'm Mike McCullough. This story was made possible by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. For this story and more, visit frequencynews.ca.
Welcome to Gardening with Embark. Welcome, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society.
Hi, nice to be here.
Good. So we are officially into summer.
Officially
finally
starting. Yes.
And we have some weather that matches that this week. What are we looking at in the garden this week?
Okay, so as you mentioned, this week is the official start of the summer. Tomorrow, June 21st, the summer solstice, and summer is here. In the garden, we can see most of our alliums, garlics, leeks, and onions. They are into flower.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the time that we gardeners are waiting for harvesting garlic escapes, which if you're a chef, you know that they're very precious, very, very subtle, nice taste of garlic, not too strong. And yeah, and if you have planted leeks and yep, went into escapes, that is done, because now you have a wooden center,
mm-hmm,
and there is nothing to eat. So it's just a core, hardcore in the middle. So you lost your leeks.
Okay, so... If your leeks are still there,
yep,
you've missed your mark.
You missed it. Yeah, the same with the onions. Yeah, yep. So now there is a hard stem in the middle. Yeah.
So we're taking all those out. We're looking at our garlics and getting ready to harvest them.
With the garlics, if you want to have fresh garlics, you can pull them out. Yep. If you want to have garlics that you can preserve for the fall, just leave it in the soil until the leaves wilted and turn yellow. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And they'll be fine like that.
Yeah, they will be fine. Yeah. So
how long can you leave them like that?
Well, I will say until the beginning of fall.
Okay.
Yeah, because now once they are, what we want to prevent is that with the fall comes lots of rainfall.
Yeah.
And we don't want them to get moldy. So yeah, mm-hmm, we need to pull before that.
And is that true for other similar sorts of root crops? I mean, I guess not carrots and stuff, but you know, I guess, you know, you sort of, you, for us non, you know, gardeners, you sort of think, well, if it's ready, it's got to come out. So I find that really interesting that you can just sort of let the garden or let the garlic wait there.
With the garlic, no problem. With other vegetables like carrots, carrots are biennial. So yeah, in the first year, the plant put lots of nutrients into the root. Mm-hmm. And the second year, they will make the flower. So
right,
that's why we like to have carrots over the winter. So the stills are edible, but before the spring next year, you need to harvest. Otherwise, it will make a flower. The same with beets, biennial plants. With leeks, yeah, unfortunately, it's all lost. But we have two options. One, to keep the leek so it goes to a nice pom-pom flower, which will be good food for the bees.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, you can harvest the seeds later if you want to. If you have an organic variety of leeks that you can harvest the seeds.
Great. So we're also looking at getting ready to put some beans in the ground.
Yes, so we still have the last opportunity to put beans, and so we hopefully we harvest before the fall, so by the September we can be harvesting.
So have we done a cycle of beans already?
And we not yet. We just planted, but because of the weather so changing, wet, dry, most of the beans have, in our garden, most of the beans did not germinate it.
Yeah,
so they're rotting in the soil, so now it's... Hopefully, we can plant again and have a harvest before the fall.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Now that we've got some bit of dry weather, we're going to get them in the ground.
Yes.
But we're also getting a little short on time for whether we're going to get a good bounty when they come ready in the fall.
In the fall, that's right. Yeah. So it's just like a try now and hope that everything was well. Yeah. as well, in the garden at the moment, we have planted fava bean. And all those fava beans are covered with a black aphid. From top to bottom, they are covered with aphids. But we have cabbages. Is that
because of the dampness so far?
Well, that regularly the fava bean is very susceptible to aphids, so they just show up.
Yeah.
But those aphids are specific for the fava bean. They don't affect any other kale crop or cabbage crop. Yeah. So cabbage, kales, they are next door, they are just fine.
Okay.
But so don't get too worried about the aphids having in the fava bean.
Yeah.
At the moment, I like to see whether there are ladybugs.
Yeah.
Laying eggs in the fava bean and as well eating all those aphids.
So it's a problem that might take care of itself.
Yeah. It takes care of itself.
Great. And what else are we looking at? I mean, we're also planting some flowers, which.
Yes. I like to plant some pansies from seed, because pansies by default they go into nice flowers. Mm-hmm. Pansies are plants that stand very well the frost.
Right.
And so over the winter when we have these cold months and dark months, having some flowers in the garden is beautiful.
And with the pansies, we're just putting seeds in the ground and then letting them come up.
Yes. So we just see them very very shallow because they're tiny seeds. Yeah. And they will germinate and we keep watering and keeping an eye on them. And hopefully by fall, they start flowering and they slowly move into winter. And it's lovely to have flowers in winter.
Yeah, certainly.
Together with the snowdrops, so pansies, snowdrops. Yep.
So now that the weather is here, and as we said, we're now really into summer, we can expect a lot of hot weather, and sunshine, which is great for our growing, but also, I imagine, also means we have to be thinking more about taking care of the garden.
Yes. So hot weather, sunny weather means for us gardeners be early in the garden, watering.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you water between 6 and 8 o'clock before this sun really gets too hot, and then you all wait in the afternoon between 5 and 7 o'clock at night. So that's the time to water. So it's very, very busy. Again, I go back always to my schedule twice a week, watering twice a week, either Tuesdays and Fridays or Mondays and Thursdays, but making sure that for the weekend your plants are being watered. Over weekends, we get very busy, barbecues, invites, visit here, visit there, and suddenly we forgot to water the garden, and when we realize all the plants are just wilted and requiring lots of watering and care. Yeah. As well, I have seen in my garden, in here, cabbage worms.
Mm-hmm.
They are feasting on the cabbages. So so all the cabbages have little holes, half of the leaves have gone, disappear suddenly.
Yeah.
So it's cabbage worms.
Okay, what are we looking for to spot those?
So cabbage worms are a tiny green worm with a yellow stripe all around their side. Yeah. And so they are very hungry. So they just eat constantly. So we usually pick them up. We pick them up and we can put in them in the composter if you want to keep it. You can feed your chickens. If you have chickens, can feed the crows or just put in a container with soapy water and there's a way to control.
And are you picking them off just with your fingers or like do you
yeah,
little you, too?
I pick them with my fingers. Yeah. They're quite soft, but we get used to handle insects and slugs and everything.
Yeah,
kind of creatures in the garden.
It's all part of the ecology of the garden.
Yes. Yeah. We the garden is a home for everyone, spiders, slugs, snails. So we just gardeners get used to handle them. Yep.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society and the manager of Embark's...
Gardens.
Gardens.
Yes.
I was going to say two gardens.
Here in campus, in Bonavie campus, we have two gardens. Yep. One behind the Task 1, the Technology and Science building, and the other one in the Student Union building.
Right, the Learning Garden.
Yep.
Excellent. And, of course, a number of programs that you're running associated with those gardens.
Oh, yes. So we have a summer cohort, which we are running currently. And in the fall, the last week of September, we will start our fall cohort. We meet for 6 weeks because it's very short.
Yeah.
During that time, we share our experience how to grow and cultivate during those times.
Great. Well, if people want to know more about Embark, how do they find out?
Please find us on our website, embarksustainability.org, or our social channels at hashtag EmbarkSustain.
Great. Thanks so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark.
Glad to be here.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Most planes are powered by jet fuel that's made from petroleum. But those same planes can be powered by what's known as sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF.
A fuel that is basically chemically identical to fossil jet so that it can be dropped into any airplane and fly just like fossil jet does.
Kim Carnahan is with the Sustainable Aviation Buyers Alliance. It's working to increase the use of SAF to help the aviation industry move away from fossil fuels. Most SAF is made with organic waste, like fat from beef processing plants or plant residue left after crops are harvested. Some is made by combining hydrogen with CO2, which can be captured from factories or power plants.
So there's a lot of different things you can make this fuel out of.
The climate benefit depends a lot on how it's made. For example, developing new farm fields to grow crops solely for SAF production could increase deforestation, erasing much of the climate benefit. SAF is also currently very expensive, in part because the market is so small. So Carnahan's group is driving investment in SAF that meets high sustainability standards to help increase production and reduce the cost of cleaner aviation fuels. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Crystal Jazz is excited to announce the 39th year of the Vancouver International Jazz Festival. With over 150 performances and over 50 free events, running from June 21st to June 30th. Highlights of the festival include Downtown Jazz, a set of opening weekend concerts on June 22nd and June 23rd in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery. The hub of the event will be Granville Island, where you'll be able to see free and ticketed shows scheduled at the Performance Works, Ocean Artworks, and the Review Stage. Featured performances this year include The Mesthetics and James Brandon Lewis performing June 23rd at the Performance Works and Killer Mike performing June 29th at Queen Elizabeth Theatre. For more information and to purchase specific concert tickets, visit www.coastaljazz.ca. Oh my.
Atención.
Yucasterio. Domingos, 6 a 8 p.m. 90.1 CJSF
Radio.
CJS
90.1 FM. Yucastereo.
Atención.